Welcome to the Dent City Podcast, a show where we chat with academics about their research on cities. I'm your co-host, Becca Mayers. On today's episode, we welcome Marco Zunino, who's a recent graduate in sustainable urbanism from the University College London's Bartlett School of Planning. After doing his master's, he moved to Whistler, BC, where he's actively involved in urban farming and circular methods for food production in cities. We're talking about his thesis, Urban Agriculture, exploring a multi-scalar and circular approach to food production and distribution in East London. We discuss urban agriculture, what it is, and Marco shares with us his case study from his research in East London, providing tools for urban planners to integrate aspects of agriculture within cities. It's been a while since we've done a food episode, despite it being so integral to the function and even the history of our cities themselves. So I'm very excited for you all to hear what Marco has to say. So Marco, thanks so much for coming on Dent City.
Thanks. It's great to be here today.
You're just up the road in Whistler. So I know we had met personally, and this is how the episode got started, just talking about your work. And I don't know much about urban agriculture. So how about you tell me and everyone listening, what is urban agriculture?
Sure. So the concept of urban agriculture might seem a little bit improbable to many, because when you think of towns and cities, you often think about housing need, infrastructure, roads, schools, jobs, etc. But the connection between kind of the urban environment and food production is pretty much where the story of civilization begins. It was kind of our mastery of agriculture that led to the development of our first urban settlement. So being able to produce a surplus of food and to store that food when times were tough allowed us to divert our resources, if you like, into other areas. So building houses, building, you know, cultural facilities, coming together and sharing stories, etc. So urban agriculture seems like an oxymoron. It doesn't seem like it should fit together, but it really is at the start of where our civilization, our civilization story begins.
What is a academic version of what urban agriculture is? We kind of know it, you know, agriculture, food production on one end, and then our own homes on the other end. What is this link between urban and the agriculture?
Sure. So it's there is a widely accepted definition within the academic literature of what kind of constitutes urban agriculture. And the definition is actually very broad and very wide. And it constitutes essentially the production, like growing, raising or producing food products or non-food products within across the whole extent of the city, from the fringe right through to the inner core, largely reusing products and outputs that we produce as a result of living in the city. You see this in the Global South, for example, much more prevalently, where local market gardens, for example, the residents have market gardens, which they then take produce to market and sell. Within the kind of Global North, you don't see it quite so often in that similar sense, because our food system has been largely outsourced out to the periphery, out into rural areas, and many city dwellers have very little idea where their food comes from. You know, meat doesn't just arrive in a styrofoam tray covered in film. So urban agriculture looks a little bit more at kind of trying to formalize, I suppose, some of those informal processes that take place across the city, from whether it be a community garden or an allotment, right the way through to other elements of food systems, such as like retail distribution, farmers markets, etc.
The sort of place and scale of urban agriculture, can you talk about the difference between the sort of circularity and then just like an industry that goes down linearly, or what would be the opposite to that?
Yeah, for sure. So I guess when you think about our current food system, it is a very linear process. So there are, food is often produced way out in kind of rural hinterlands. It relies a lot on chemical inputs, so a lot of fertilizers, a lot of pesticides. And then there are long transport chains that bring that produce into the city. So it's a very kind of linear model of resource use. Whereas urban agriculture could allow a lot more circularity in resource use, especially because the city produces so many of the inputs that are required for agriculture. So, for example, there's a lot of paving, a lot of concrete. So when it rains, when especially with climate change, we have perhaps some heavier rainfall events that take place. That water runs off, and the concrete, means that it can flash flood. There's no soft surfaces for that to absorb into. Likewise, we produce a lot of waste and a lot of organic waste, which is an incredibly important resource for the farmer. My journey through the one thing for me in my journey through into urban agriculture is how important compost is. It's like black gold because it's so critical to growing. So urban agriculture can provide the basis on which to be able to loop these resources back into the city. And using it where it's produced is the most efficient form of looping it too. So that's in terms of the circularity, it can provide that kind of basis to enable a more circular economy to exist. And then in terms of place and scale, it's kind of interesting within some of the literature, which perhaps we'll dive into a little bit later, around how a lot of urban planning traditionally has been around, or urban regeneration, should we say, in quotation marks, involves bulldozing areas, removing areas, rebuilding, especially traditionally when we look at kind of urban design. And we think back to kind of Jane Jacobs and a lot of the developments that were going on in the 50s and 60s around urban design. It was very much raise it to the ground, rebuild it. Whereas looking through the literature in relation to urban agriculture, very much it details working with the city, working with the form and the fabric of the city as it currently exists. In which case, considering place and considering the scale of interventions becomes really critical. So when we think about the city itself, obviously, traditionally, we think about the form of the city. You've got the dense core, slightly less dense outer core, and then a much less dense kind of periphery ring. So when thinking about place, that's what I'm kind of looking at through this project is looking at the form that the city is taking, that kind of place aspect, and then the scale of interventions of urban agriculture that can take place within those areas. So for example, it would be pointless to put a really big industrial greenhouse in a very dense urban core. That just doesn't make sense in terms of city form. It's probably slightly incoherent and on a design basis. So I think to integrate a connected network of urban agriculture successfully, we need to look at the context of each city that we're working with. It's the place of that city, the form of that city, and then identify which scale of intervention would work best.
Great. And what led you to research urban agriculture in the first place?
So I took a rather roundabout route on my journey towards urban agriculture. So it all started with when I was actually living in London, the UK, and I was living in East London. So it was a very dense, I think it's a very dense area of East London, it's the former Docklands. So it's kind of, I think it's 16,000 residents per square kilometre. So it's a,
Wow.
yeah, so it's a very dense, formerly industrial area before the docks moved out in the 1960s. And I commuted an hour to work. So I had no real connection to my local neighbourhood. I was living there, using it as basically a bedroom to go into the office in the city and back again. So I felt like I had no real connection to my local area. So I started getting involved in volunteering, and I found a local city farm, which developed in the 1970s. Basically, a group of residents took over some derelict land and just started growing there. And then that space became, which started as a very informal space, gradually became more formalized. So the local authority then began kind of leasing that land on a pepper pot rent. And I was fascinated by this space. So it's about 4 acres in size, and it hosts some allotments. There's a very so the area I was living in, as well, to provide some context, has a very high immigrant population. So it's about 30% of the population are from a Bangladeshi background, 30% are white, and 30% non-white. So it's kind of a very interesting and very diverse dynamic. So there's a lot of a lot there are a lot of allotments at this city farm, which the Bangladeshi community were using because they were growing produce that they couldn't find in the supermarkets here in the UK. And it also had some artisan workshops, so pottery, traditional woodcrafts, etc., and a farmers market. And when I discovered this place, I couldn't believe the energy of it, like the community, that it brought all the community together. It was always, kids were running around. Like I said, it was a very dense former industrial area of London. So a lot of the kids that growing up there didn't have, access to the countryside. They'd never been to a farm before, so to be able to come in and see sheep and donkeys and whatever, sometimes seeing the looks on their faces was just hilarious. So volunteering for this city farm, I kind of sparked my curiosity in the urban environment. Like, why was this place here? How did it develop? Why does it bring the community together? That then kind of led me into a kind of career change and a career path change, and going back to university and doing this project on urban agriculture.
Great. And then what about some of We already spoke about some of the literature that you use to inform your work, but I was really interested by the sort of benefits of urban agriculture that you saw from the literature.
Yeah, definitely. So I looked at benefits, as I say, across the that kind of structure of social, economic, and environmental sustainability. And there are significant benefits by integrating a network of urban agriculture. So the environmental benefits are probably most evident, as we spoke about earlier, around resource loops, and looping in resources back into the urban system rather than exporting, waste products miles and miles into the hinterland. And then obviously the other environmental benefit we kind of touched on was around those long transport supply chains. The interesting thing about gardens and community gardens are the social bonds that form. So I spoke earlier about the city farm that I used to volunteer at. It was a very high Bangladeshi migrant community that grew food there. So those allowing growing food and allotments and community gardens allow bonds, that social capital, I believe it's often referred to, those bonds to be formed between us within the community, that we often might not get a chance to form. A lot of those social aspects of what used to form a community have kind of ebbed away in recent times. So it used to be the church, in the middle of a, bring people together every Sunday, or the cinema would bring people in. I mean, Whistler, for example, has just lost its cinema. It just closed down about 12 months ago. So these mechanisms which allow social bonds to form are kind of feels that they're eroding over time. Whereas community gardens and growing food and those that are interested in food allows those social bonds to actually be formed by people to come together within those sites of practice. And then, in terms of economic benefits, there is essentially it's reintegrated, it's circulating capital back into the local economy. So rather than when you're buying food products or buying food, rather than those profits going to large corporations that do a lot of their business elsewhere, it looks at cycling that capital back into the local economy. So it's much more, you get much more bang for your buck when you're spending locally, essentially.
Yeah, so like when you buy something at a local farmer's market, you're supporting the person who's producing that food maybe 50 kilometers away
Exactly.
rather than, 10 kilometers away, yeah.
Exactly. And they're employing somebody locally to work on that farm. And in turn, if it's a regenerative farm as well locally, then they're probably sourcing inputs for their farm from local output. So it allows more circular kind of resource flows.
You mean the waste outputs that we spoke about earlier?
Exactly.
Always comes back to poop.
It does. It's inevitable.
Yeah, but like you said, the sort of the gold of an urban farm is also the waste of the urban output.
Exactly.
Was there any other literature that you wanted to touch on before we go into the methodology?
Yeah, sure. So as I was just as we touched on earlier, because it's a design-based thesis, so looking at the city form was absolutely essential. And some of those kind of concepts of how the city developed, which is ultimately a lot of it ties back to transportation. So that dense urban core often developed as a result of walking city. That was the transportation method we had at that time, which then broadened out to a kind of more of a transit-based city when rail lines developed and it allowed us to go a little bit further out. And then finally, there's the automobile city, which allowed for much broader, less dense developments, usually around the outskirts of the city. So kind of looking at that, the history of how cities developed and city form was critical to that design-based element. And then looking more specifically at urban agriculture, I drew heavily on the concept of continuous productive urban landscapes as proposed by Filon and Bohn. So they have an architectural practice in London and in Germany, and it focuses on producing these continuous networks of space to produce food. And in particular, as I mentioned earlier, it looks at working with the form of the city rather than in a destructive way. So working with the buildings and the infrastructure, the general fabric of the city that's already there, working within that rather than like raising it to the ground and starting from scratch. Then in terms of looking at the kind of structure of agricultural provision, I touched a little bit on transitions theory. So this looks particularly at how we transition from one system of provision to another. And it's really quite interesting when you think about behavioral change and how difficult it can be to achieve behavioral change. And within the transitions theory literature that I was reading, there is this interesting concept developed by Spargaren, which he identifies three factors within transitions theory that can lock in current behaviors, and how important it is to work against these factors to enable a new system of provision to develop. And those three factors are around infrastructure lock-in effects. So, for example, if you look at food, it's around the prevalence of the big supermarket businesses, the prevalence of specific food production corporations, I suppose, and that kind of link between those corporate producers and distributors. Second factor is the vested interests within that system. So obviously, within that system of provision, there are big players and the interests of those players to maintain the system as it currently is. And then the third factor is the addictive routines of consumers. So that means things like, as we were talking about earlier, like kind of convenience foods, how cheap kind of mass-produced industrial food is. And these kind of notions of market choice as well. So we think having the current food system provides us with endless choice of food products. But if you really kind of pull back the surface, you see that's a bit of a fallacy because you walk into any supermarket and you'll generally get the same five products. You get zucchini, eggplants, lettuce, onions, potatoes. There's not really any diversity of supply truly when you look under the surface.
Unless it's chips.
Yeah, indeed. Well, indeed. And then you can find any. I'm always amazed by the flavors of chips over here. It's amazing what choice you get there. That's
Yeah,
true.
I guess these sort of food competitors and keeping the consumer sort of locked in to the supermarket, you know, is it about making the supermarket worse or, you know, in order for us to want something else? Or, you know, what's the solution to making us change our behavior when these things are just so well designed to keep us shopping at them? You know, they offer these cheap, you know, perceived choices and just keep us coming back week after week because they're all in one place.
Definitely, yeah, and that's a really, really good question. So, in trying to change behavior, I think sometimes the worst thing we can do is take something away. And I think we often see this when we think about cars as well, and the prevalence of the car and the vehicle. As soon as you start talking about parking or you know, taking, you know, closing down streets, the pushback effects that you sometimes get as a result of that can be completely counterproductive. So, and it's similar in within when we're looking at the food system. I'm sure there are many people that really have no desire whatsoever to get their hands dirty and to get growing food. But what it is about is allowing spaces for alternative systems of provision to develop. So kind of within the literature, these are called niches. So you have this have a either an institutional framework, so local government bylaws or food policy councils, etc. Generally, you know, a supportive policy structure that allows niches of urban agriculture to develop over time. And then those niches then form networks with each other. What does that mean in practical terms? Because it sounds a little bit of a, you know, fuzzy concept. Like, what does that mean practically? So, recently in the UK, there's a city called Hull, and the council literally just last month has voted unanimously to allow the right to grow amongst its population. So it's produced a list of public lands that can be grown on. And they'll now offer free leases to community groups that come together that want to grow on that land. So by implementing that policy, they've created space for people within the community with an interest to come together and grow. They've legitimized, if you like, what may have been seen as an illegitimate activity before. I mean, I think guerrilla gardening is incredibly legitimate, and I'd encourage everybody to do it. But by formalizing it somewhat, you create these avenues for urban agriculture to then form. So people then grow food. If it then takes place at a sufficient scale, those growers may look to get their products to market. So then they might start lobbying for more farmers market provision or to allow for some form of space on Main Street to develop. So for example, we're now seeing the prevalence of bulk food stores a little bit more regularly. So, for example, I know specifically in London, for example, there was a shop that opened on my local Main Street, which looked to provide goods without plastic. So you go there with your Tupperware, you'd fill it up with rice, you'd fill it up with pasta, they weigh it, and you take that home. And that retail space also provided a little bit of concession space for food that was grown locally. So local producers then form networks and form bonds with other businesses that kind of support that distribution kind of framework and model. So by allowing these niches to develop over time, you get a parallel system that runs alongside the current system of provision. And that then allows for more diversity in supply. And diversity ultimately leads to a more dynamic system, which is more resilient to shocks.
So, in creating your design toolkit, how did you go about analyzing each area?
Yeah, sure. So After the literature review, the project drew extensively on case studies and current examples of urban agriculture around the city. So I used case studies in London, where I was living, but also much more broadly as well. So there's some great examples here in North America of urban agricultural practice in cities. So the literature kind of provided the basis of why urban agriculture is important, so that diversity of systems, etc., the environmental problems. Whereas the case studies provided the how, in terms of how we're going to achieve a more connected network of urban agriculture within our cities. So in terms of practical terms, I relied really extensively on GIS mapping of the case study area that I chose. And there's con within the context of London, the amount of open source data there is that can be, mapped and put into GIS is incredible. I had no background in GIS. I basically self-taught. There's a really good open source program called QGIS. So if anybody's interested in it, I'd really recommend to get involved in that. And then yeah, just get hold of files from a lot of municipalities provide their urban data on open source. So get hold of it, create your own GIS map, and away you go.
And what were the research questions that led your GIS analysis?
Sure. So there's kind of three overarching components to my research question. So the initial question itself was, how can a multi-scalar approach to urban agriculture be applied to the city to encourage local food production and distribution, as well as integrating more circular resource use? And within that, there were three main spokes. So the first one was the productive potential of the city. So how can productive land be unlocked, and how much food could we grow? And the second spoke was around why bring food production into the city. So why is it important? And then the final element was looking at which urban systems and resources could be integrated into a system of urban agriculture.
And then for your site selection, what kind of guided your decisions?
Yeah, sure. So the site I chose was an area of East London, around Tower Hamlets is the name of the boroughs. It was also where I used to live. So it had a significant number of food assets already within the area. So there were four city farms, and the area provides a rather interesting topography. So it moves from a very dense core quite quickly out to a peri-urban area within the space of about 14 kilometers. And then within that area, I then started looking at applying elements of the design toolkit, essentially.
And what were the findings from this analysis?
Sure. So the toolkit provides two general areas of operation. So the first is around how to locate your network of urban agriculture. So that's all about identifying the strategic assets in the area. So looking at the referring to the site that I chose in East London, that involved identifying water courses. Like, water is critical to growing food. So identifying kind of tributary networks, rivers, canals, areas where water is prevalent. It also looked at identifying sources of waste heat. Now, heat isn't necessarily critical to growing food, but it increases yield and it gives you a longer growing season when you use greenhouses. So the city produces a lot of waste heat, but also allows potential to tap into those networks. So district heating networks, for example, a lot of industrial processes. So composting actually generates a lot of heat. Wastewater treatment generates a lot of heat, etc. So looking at those areas, those kind of facilities that produce a lot of heat, where you can potentially stick a greenhouse. And the kind of third element was looking at industrial land. Now, that doesn't sound very, it sounds counterintuitive. Why would we look at industrial land about growing food? But industrial land within the city often houses a lot of big box stores. So big buildings, often quite low to the ground, three or four stories, with big flat roofs. So identifying those roof structures for gentle identity. So basically stick a greenhouse on top of it. Then you have an added benefit of being able to channel the heat from the business below, provide insulation, so it's energy efficient, and you allow much broader kind of air surface area that you can then use for growing food. So those are the three strategic assets that I looked to identify with the design toolkit, and that was primarily through using GIS mapping. And then once those areas were identified, then the design toolkit looked at what we could integrate into a network of urban agriculture. So that's where understanding city form is so important. So I looked at three different zones. There's the inner zone of the city, more dense, much higher land value, much less space to grow. Then there's the middle zone, which is that transition from the dense core to essentially the outer zone, which is more like the peri-urban area, much lower density, and much higher provision of things like industrial parks and industrial zones. So
So where would the suburbs kind of fit? Would that be in like the middle or outer?
indeed, the suburbs would be more kind of middle towards outer zone, for sure. And it can be tricky because in the post-industrial city, the patterns of development no longer follow such, kind of rigid lines of development, if you like. It's become much more, or the fabric of the city has become much more complex, and you find pockets of less dense area in the middle and more dense area on the outskirts.
Yeah, you can get a suburb of low density housing in the
Exactly,
inner zone.
absolutely. So it's not a perfect kind of regular way to kind of look at the city, but it definitely helps when you come to understand the scale of intervention, and that's the other factor within the design toolkit. So I looked at a whole host of case studies of urban agriculture design interventions and looked to categorize them in terms of their scale. So what does that mean? Well, on the outskirts of the city, in the outer zone, you tend to find interventions that are much more on a macro scale. So that's the largest intervention size. So within the area that I was looking at in East London, we had a 49,000 square meter regenerative farm that was right on the peri-urban area, just within kind of the peripheral motorway of the city, so it was a large scale regenerative farm produced. They produced a lot of produce that they sold through CSA, so community supported agriculture schemes. And then as we come into the city, we see similar types of intervention, but at a different scale. So at the meso scale of intervention, which is a step down from that macro large scale, we have things like Stepney City Farm, which is where I volunteered. So that's much kind of smaller in scale. It's 1,666 meters square. And that's kind of within a much more dense, that medium density. So it's in the middle zone of the city. There's a little bit more space, but not as big that you could have a large regenerative farm. And then at the micro scale, you have things like community gardens. So there was a community garden just down the road from where I lived, which was about 150 meters square. So much, much smaller, but doing the same types of thing, growing food, allowing sites for composting, waste, rainwater capture systems, etc. So the design toolkit kind of ties together that city form, so those zones, inner, middle, and outer, with the scale of intervention that then takes place. So whether that be at macro scale, mesoscale, or micro. Now, you can have interventions So it doesn't always follow that routine pattern. So you can have micro interventions in the outer zone of the city. Just depends on the context of what you're looking at.
And then, did you look at some opportunities how of future research?
One thing that's really critical is looking at how and why sites of urban agriculture develop in the first place. So my project kind of took case studies that looked at sites that were, already existing. So kind of like those assets that were already in a particular place, and propose more, like propose connecting up the street network to existing assets through to the peri-urban area to give that connected network. But it doesn't really delve into why those sites developed in the first place and what sustains them as well. Like, why do they keep going 30, 40 years after they developed? And I think that could be a really fruitful vein for potential research, to see, what mechanisms allow urban agriculture to develop so that we can then look to embed those mechanisms within, local food policy frameworks.
So for maybe local governments who don't have a policy and no one knocking on their door to say, hey, we want this, maybe going to the community and saying, we are going to create this set of policies and hope that people kind of take them up and there's nothing standing in their way.
Exactly. Yeah, to remove any barriers and provide, provide growing opportunities, essentially.
And then, what about like opportunities for this research in practice? So, how would one implement this design toolkit?
Yeah, sure. So, hopefully, it gives a methodology through which anybody that's interested or any urban planners that want to integrate a network of urban agriculture can look to see, really how it could be potentially done. So, looking at how to identify those strategic assets of resources. So, we spoke about, water, compost, and heat, but also mapping existing urban agricultural resources too. So, existing community gardens, existing green, like community greenhouse spaces, and looking to identify those assets in first instance. And then it provides some design ideas around how you could. One could connect together those assets, so to produce a much more, connected network that forms part of the city, brings the citizen much closer to food growing, much closer to the seasonality of our produce, brings them closer to how delicious fresh food tastes as well. And then, yeah, so and then being able to implement those design ideas within the context of the city in which they're working. So whether that be planters at a smaller scale, community gardens at a slightly larger scale, as well as looking at design interventions which strengthen those gardens that currently exist. And by that I mean integrating elements of the kind of sharing economy, like tool libraries, community kitchens, so that it strengthens the communities that are already there in the first place.
Right. Keeping that social capital alive, the sort of.
And well, it's interesting how much the urban form can influence that as well. So when we think about, the suburbs and how power dependent they are, low density, and how isolating those areas can potentially be as well. Like there are, fewer mechanisms through which we can talk to our neighbors or get involved. I mean, Canada is probably a little bit more social, a little bit more, more chatty. I know in the UK it can be quite isolating. Like London can be quite an anonymous city, and you could go for years without ever knowing neighbours. And living in a block of flats, you might not ever know who's next door to you. You might talk to them and they think you're a bit crazy. So the urban form can be so important at creating those relationships and bonds with each other.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like even in London, which you'd think in your mind is designed in a way that is dense and is walkable and would provide spaces for people to hang out and chat, but then you don't even know the people who are living really actually in close proximity to you. It's more than just the design of the spaces, it's also like the social production of those spaces and connection and what brings people together and having a reason to come together in the first place, other than just proximity.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Yeah. So just to conclude and to end us off here, is there anything you want to leave our listeners with today, thinking about food? Now I'm hungry.
Definitely. So for sure, I hope that one key takeaway is how important the food system is. It's often neglected. We often don't think about it. We take it for granted. However, it really is a crucial urban system, and it links to so many urban problems that we have. So we think about food insecurity and inequality, food deserts in towns, nutrition and health, a lot of spending on health, which is, you know, ultimately related to poor diet, waste and greenhouse gas emissions, biodiversity, community cohesion, you name it. There is food can provide the basis on which to link a lot of these areas together and produce more sustainable cities. So rather than thinking of it as something that takes place in the countryside, miles and miles away, or in far and distant lands, I would really love for urban planners to start really focusing on the importance of food provision and, you know, productive spaces. And you do see that. I mean, take Squamish as an example, just down the road. It's got it's got a food policy council. The Squamish Climate Action Network is looking now at the moment at trying to tie together local producers with restaurants and distributors. We have amazing farmland in Pemberton Meadows, just up here, the north of Whistler, with some amazing regenerative farms doing community supported agriculture schemes. So please buy CSA boxes, people. That's a really support your local producers. You know, it's more expensive, but they're paying their workers well. You know, the food isn't coming thousands of miles. And when it's fresh, it tastes better as well. I think one thing I'd really love to try and find out, and I'm not sure if any of your listeners would be able to help, but I used to love to compost, and I can't anymore because of the bear problem. Well, not bear problem. I can't anymore because obviously we share our habitat here in the Cedar Sky with bears. So we can't compost in, you know, within our homes. We have to take it to like local, you know, kind of waste transfer stations, which is good. But the best you can do as a gardener is make your own compost. So I'd love to hear if anybody knows any solutions to composting in bear country without, you know, endangering bears or putting people at risk would be amazing. And the knowledge systems of the global south and indigenous knowledge, we could learn so much from those indigenous knowledge systems around how to produce food, how to, you know, produce locally and care for, you know, be the custodians of the land on which we are on to preserve it for future generations. And, you know, when you grow food, it's critical that the land you grow on is well treated. You don't want to pollute where you're going to be growing. So learning from those kind of indigenous knowledge systems and practice from the global south could be really critical too.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, thank you so much for giving us all your knowledge today. where can people reach you if they want to get a hold of you?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Instagram. So I have a guerrilla gardening account. So my handle is mountainmtn.guerrilla. So the Guerrilla Gardener on Instagram is my social handle. I'm on LinkedIn as well. So please feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn if you're interested at all. And I would encourage everyone to start with just a little pot of herbs. Do with a little thyme plant, a little rosemary plant. Just keep it in your kitchen. Keep that watered. Saves you from having to buy herbs at the supermarket, which are wrapped in plastic, and they taste delicious.
Definitely. Well, thanks so much, Marco. Have a good rest of your day.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Bye. Thanks for your time today.
That's it for now. And thank you so much for listening. A big thanks to Marco for joining us on this episode. You can follow him on Instagram at mtn.gorilla or reach out to him on LinkedIn. Be sure to share and subscribe for updates on future episodes. Feel free to contact me on Twitter or Instagram at densitypod to keep this conversation going. A special thanks to Emily Huang of emilyh.illustrations for creating the artwork for this podcast. You can check out more of her work by following the link in the show notes. Another thank you to Reed Kai and Ryan Kinnear for the show music. See you next time on Dense City.